evening, my friends. I'm Eric Olson, and it's time once again for America's Most Haunted Radio, bringing together the finest minds and personalities from across the paranormal spectrum.
And there you go, Eric. Just for you, man.
All right. Thank you, Joel Sturgis. The world-famous ass-kicking Joel Sturgis is running the board for America's Most Haunted. And because Teresa Argy, the world-famous haunted housewife, had a scheduling conflict for the evening, Joel will also be stopping in now and then as co-host. We are honored, my friends. And what a show we have tonight. We're previewing the Contact in the Desert UFO Conference with New York Times bestselling author and investigative journalist Jim Mars, Joshua Tree historian and giant rock expert. This woman knows all about giant rocks, Barbara Harris, and the event organizer, the grand poobah of Contact in the Desert, Paul Andrews. This year, which is only the third year, the eagle is landing at the third annual Contact in the Desert as celebrated American astronauts Edgar Mitchell and Story Musgrave join headliners Chariots of the Gods author Eric Von Daniken, Ancient Aliens legend with the freaky ass hair, Giorgio Tsoukalos. Someone will tell me. I bet it'll be Jim. And our bud, Judge George Norrie, who we just saw over the weekend at the Kent Paranormal Weekend. He is also a UFO guy. He's host, of course, of Coast to Coast Radio AM. And an army of additional UFO experts and agitators will be at the Joshua Tree Conference Center May 29th through 31st. It's a couple months earlier this year. Interested to hear why they've made that change. But up first with us is Jim Mars. Welcome, Jim.
Hey, guys. It's great to be with you.
What a pleasure. Yes, I think you were, in fact, on with us last year when we were previewing the show, and I was staggered by the width and breadth of your knowledge and background and experience, for that matter. For those who live in caves, let's tell them who you are. Award-winning investigative journalist and best-selling author Jim Mars will speak on topics addressed in his latest book, Our Occulted History, Do the Global Elite Conceal Ancient Aliens? Addressing the omissions and distortions in history, from the strange Star Child skull to the exact location of Atlantis, to the genesis of Rh-negative blood types and the powerful families of the black nobility, no stone will be left unturned. Wow. I want to go, Jim, but I guess you'll give us a little bit of a preview. How are you?
Well, I'm doing just lovely, and I can answer your question, the burning question of why they moved it from August till the end of May.
Please.
Well, apparently there were some folks who came from Yankee climates who decided it was just too hot in the desert in August.
In the middle of August.
Back to May so that it wouldn't be quite so hot.
It'll
course,
still be warm,
of course, I'm from
whatever.
Texas, and it seemed pretty normal to me.
Yeah, boy, I hadn't even thought of that. Yep, August in the desert, even though it's the high desert, I believe.
Right.
Is nonetheless very, very toasty. All right.
I found it personally pretty comfortable because, yes, in the height of the day, it got pretty hot, but it was a dry heat, and if you got in the shade, you were kind of okay. And at night, it actually got fairly cool. And, of course, where I come from down here in Texas, when it gets August, it's hot in the daytime, and it's hot at night.
Oh, yeah. Well, I'm a big baseball fan, so I'm always hearing what the poor Rangers have to deal with. I guess they have a retractable roof now, don't they, on the stadium?
Yeah, or some kind of giant air conditioner. I don't know.
Because that's what they're always saying. It's not just that it's 95 to 105 or whatever in the day, but that it barely cools off at night. And you're right, in the high desert. I'm actually from Southern California, so I've been out there a lot. My parents used to own some land out in Apple Valley. Mm-hmm. And kind of year-round, it really does cool off at night.
Right. Yeah, I've seen it 95, 100 degrees at midnight. Here in North Texas.
Whoa, boy. Well, that's some heat.
Yeah, it is. But this is going to be a lot better. I think in May the temperatures will be real pleasant, and the desert is a dry place. It's really nice. In fact, I think a lot of people are getting in on the action, because this will make the third year that I've attended the Contact in the Desert. And the first year they were expecting, I think, about 400 people, and they ended up with more than 600 or 700. So they expanded their facilities and prepared for more. And the second year they were going to hopefully get maybe up to 800 or so, and they had over 1,000. And then last summer they were preparing for, oh, maybe 1,200, and they had, I believe they had almost 2,000 people there. So it's really exciting, because that what that shows me is something that I've kind of decided anyway in my travels around the country, that there is a consciousness raising going on among the public, and the interest is interesting too. 2 years ago, the people who were there were mostly interested in the UFO issue, but last year I noticed a whole lot of people that were there were not only interested in UFOs and possible ET visitation, but also wanted to know about government conspiracies and who was behind 9/11 and who killed Kennedy. And I mean, I don't know. There just seems to be a general consciousness raising going on in the country.
And who better to talk of such things than the original JFK conspiracy digger-upper person? Archaeologist, you, the world famous Jim Mars. I remember we were talking about that, and I had a vague notion of your background. Certainly was aware of who you are prior to our last talk, but I didn't realize that you really were the guy to popularize some of these underlying issues and theories, regarding the JFK assassination, which is still, I guess, to this day, the one that people are most just maniacal and fanatical about.
Right. Well, I think that's because there is so much more known now today than on so many of the other conspiratorial topics. And yes, I've been on it since the day it happened. I was a sophomore at North Texas University studying for a degree in journalism, and that was only about 30 miles north of Dallas. In fact, I'd been in Dallas. Had lots of my roommates were from Dallas, and in fact, I got a picture of me dancing in Jack Ruby's Carousel Club that was taken a month before the Kennedy assassination and before Jack Ruby, his name, got to be so notorious. And I was well aware of who was running Dallas and the politics at the time. And then I was up gathering information and watching TV within about 15 or 20 minutes of the shooting. So I've been on it from the get-go. And then in the mid-70s, about 1975, I believe, I was invited to teach a course on the Kennedy assassination at the University of Texas in Arlington, there between Dallas and Fort Worth. And so every fall, every spring, I'd be rerunning those newsreels and announcements and pictures and documents. And so the whole thing, it's hard for me to believe that that's been more than 50 years ago.
Well, Jim,
because it's still fresh in my mind.
I hate to bust in here, guys, but I've never been able to ask Jim this question. I always want to interview you, Jim. Never had a chance. Who killed Kennedy?
Well, first you have to answer, do you want to know, are you asking who pulled the trigger, or are you asking who was behind it?
Ooh, I think, Lee Harvey Oswald.
Yes.
Yes, but see, when I was a kid, we were taught, just to give a little background where the question's coming from, we were always taught it was Lee Harvey Oswald, of course. Like everybody. But
well,
who,
that's the official verdict, but now who, that's been severely called into question.
Who orchestrated it?
In fact, I think an objective look at all the evidence would probably show you that Lee Harvey Oswald, if he even fired a shot that day, and that's a huge big if, because just as the Dallas police chief back in the 70s said, you know, we never could put Oswald in that window with that rifle, which is absolutely true. But if Oswald even fired a shot, he certainly was not alone, There was another shot from the grassy knoll and possibly even other locations, which by very definition means there was a conspiracy. Now, if there was a conspiracy, and here we are 52-3 years later, and we don't know the truth of that conspiracy, then that can only be laid at the feet of federal officials who told us and still try to maintain that it was only Oswald by himself. And so then that is what has elevated what at the time was simply another Texas homicide into a national coup d'etat.
Just one more quick note here, and I'll let Eric get back. What I found out just through doing my own little bit of digging, and nowhere near the extent that you have done, I have kind of come across that it could have been George W. or George Bush Sr. He was the director of the CIA at the time.
No, he did not become director of the CIA until our only unelected president, Gerald R. Ford, appointed him head of the CIA about 1975.
Interesting.
But there is evidence to show that George Herbert Walker Bush was in Dallas at the time. And in fact, there is a photograph that many people believe is him standing in front of the Texas School Book Depository at the time of the assassination.
Wow, I've never heard that one. The first president, George Bush?
Yes, George Herbert Walker Bush.
Well, too many names.
Right. He's the father of George W.
Exactly. These patricians have too many names.
That's right.
Okay, well, that is interesting. Very interesting.
I interviewed a fella who, as a young boy, his father was involved in Texas politics at the time, and he knew George Herbert Walker Bush, and in fact encountered him in the hallway of the Adolphus Hotel the night before the Kennedy assassination, in a hallway speaking with, whispering with none other than Richard Nixon.
Wow.
So that puts both of them in Dallas the night before the assassination. And there's really never been any question about Nixon, because he was in Dallas that morning and, in fact, flew out just prior to the shooting.
So what, after all of these years, nay, decades, of teaching the topic, obviously you researched it extraordinarily thoroughly before you wrote the book, and we haven't even mentioned that you were a consultant on the Oliver Stone JFK film. So you participated in that and provided information.
Right.
What is your personal opinion on what happened? Who ultimately is behind it?
Okay. President Kennedy, had, by the fall of 1963, had made the horrendous mistake of actually believing he was president of the United States. And he was taking actions that he truly believed would be in the best interest of the people of this country, and that includes shutting down the Vietnam War. He said he agreed with pulling all United States troops out of Vietnam by the end of 65, and in fact, in early November of 63, he even said, make no formal announcement, but begin the withdrawal of 1,000 military advisors. So he was going to shut down the Vietnam War. His brother, Robert Kennedy, as Attorney General, was prosecuting organized crime like never before or since. And in fact, one of the members of the Kennedy family once told me that if the assassination had not taken place, that by another few years, they may have eliminated all organized crime in the United States. Think about that. He was in communication with Khrushchev, and they were very serious about ending the Cold War at that time. He also, in 1962, passed the Kennedy Tax Act, where he began to close the tax loopholes for the multinational corporations, okay, which are now so dominant in our life. So he was, and of course, he was pushing for civil rights, and so he had managed to anger and alienate all the important violent groups in this country, the CIA, the FBI, the military, the anti-Castro Cubans, the mafia, and we now know that they were all at certain places, certain levels, working together. And so the word was passed, nobody's going to get too upset if something happened to Kennedy. And so this allowed them to push through with some of their contingency plans. We know, I think it's centered in the Operation Mongoose, which was the secret war against Castro. In that war, which was being run out of the Jim Wave station on the campus of the University of Miami, we see a nexus of CIA, U.S. military, anti-Castro Cubans, mafia hitmen, and they're all working together. And I think the word came that the real problem was not in Havana, it was in Washington, D.C., so they simply sent some of these hit squads to Dallas. But, of course, they needed cover and they needed a scapegoat, so they found Lee Harvey Oswald, a patriotic young American who had become embroiled with the CIA, with Naval Intelligence when he entered the Marine Corps, and they sent him to Russia on some kind of mission. And then when he came back, they used him and set him up to be the patsy in the assassination. And he used that term himself in Dallas when they asked him if he killed the president. And essentially he said, no, I haven't killed anybody. I'm just a patsy, which is really interesting because when he says I'm a patsy, that's more than just saying I didn't do it. That's saying I was set up to take the blame for this, which is true. And the truth of the assassination, there were multiple gunmen. It was a military-style ambush, multiple shots fired, maybe as many as 9 or 10. This is what the acoustical scientist of the House Select Committee on Assassinations testified. They said there were as many as 10 sounds on the Dallas police radio tapes that they could not rule out as being gunshots. And yet, since they only test-fired from two locations, 6th floor of the book depository building and the fence on the grassy knoll, they could only say with scientific probability that shots came from those two locations, but it might have come from other. And it was the cover-up of the truth of the assassination. I'll give you one glaring example. The night of the assassination, against all law and protocol, on orders from Washington, all of the evidence in the case was taken away from the Dallas police and shipped to the FBI in Washington, which, of course, was under the total domination of one man, J. Edgar Hoover. The next day, there was a document signed by Hoover himself that said their fingerprint experts could not find any usable fingerprints on the rifle or the clip or even the disassembled parts of the rifle, so there's no fingerprints. On Sunday, that rifle was shipped back to Dallas. On Monday morning, two FBI agents, Harrison and Vincent Drain, carried the rifle over to Miller Funeral Home in Fort Worth, where they were preparing Oswald's body for burial. The funeral home director, Paul Grudy, who I was very good friends with at the time because I became the police reporter for the 4-Star Telegram, and he was one of my really good news sources because in addition to running the funeral home, they also ran the ambulance service that picked up all the shootings and crashes and everything else. And he told me years ago, and then has repeated this on national radio just a few years ago, that he was present when the FBI came in and placed Oswald's dead hand on the rifle. And it was that night that Henry Wade, the district attorney of Dallas, was speaking to the news media, and he says, have I mentioned we've got his fingerprints on the rifle? Well, that pretty well cinched his guilt in the minds of the public. So this is it was the cover-up. Anybody could have killed Kennedy, including the proverbial lone nut. The thing that really is telling is not the shooting itself, but the subsequent cover-up. And it was this cover-up that transformed what legally at that time was simply another Texas homicide into a national coup d'etat, a coup.
But dang, that is the mind reels, the mind boggles. It's an amazing, amazing story. We could do about 5 shows just on that. And clearly, you are the man for the topic. I guess we do need to address a bit of contact in the desert. What will you be talking about there?
Well, they've got me scheduled for several talks. One of them is going to be the evidence, which I have since spoken to some other compatriots that have been studying the same material I have, and we're all kind of under the opinion that the evidence for ancient astronauts or extraterrestrial visitation on the Earth in prehistoric times is at the worst compelling and at best overwhelming. It's just there. You just have to, all you have to do is look at it. And there's been a tremendous cover up in that area too. So we're going to be talking about the evidence for extraterrestrial presence, not only on the Earth, but in our solar system. That goes back to prehistory. And then at another talk, I'm going to raise the question of, well, assuming all that's correct and there was this extraterrestrial presence on the Earth in the distant past, what happened? Did they all leave? Or at least some of them still, are they still around? If they are, who are they and where are they? And I will try to answer those questions.
Ooh, you are leaving me hanging. I have pins and needles being pushed.
Come to contact in the desert.
We better get there. Can you give us a little bit of a hint? Give us a little clue about some little tidbit that you're going to put out there.
Oh, it's not astonishing. I can tell you the gist of it, which is there is really no question that there is a handful of people, very wealthy, very powerful, who control the vast majority of the giant multinational corporations on this world. And what I went into my book, Our Occulted History, with a working hypothesis, it was, can they be tracked back to the stories and legends? And the answer, yes.
Wow. You mean an actual unbroken timeline?
Pretty much. And it all connects through the secret societies that are all connected. Today, the Bilderberg bunch that meets once a year, and the inner core elite that belong to Council on Foreign Relations and its spinoff, the Trilateral Commission, and all of that was created by Cecil Rhodes' round tables, which he himself called a secret society, which was an outgrowth of Illuminized Freemasonry, which grew out of the Freemason movement and was imbued with the Illuminati ideals. And that tracks back to the fact that the Freemasons were formed by the Knights Templars, who gained all this esoteric knowledge during the Crusades over in the Holy Land. And the knowledge they gained came from the mystery schools of Rome and Greece, which then were predicated on the mystery schools of ancient Egypt, which in fact were simply the ancient knowledge handed down from the world's first real civilization in Sumer, or the Sumerian civilization, which was between the Tigris and Euphrates rivers, in the one place in the world today that we can't just freely go travel to, and that is now, of course, Iraq. All right, and then according to the ancient Sumerian tablets, about 500,000 of which are still in existence, on not once but several places where they begin the history, it says that about more than 300,000 years ago, the Anunnaki arrived. Well, the Anunnaki have been translated as those who came from the heavens and landed on the earth. So there you go. And
so now I am just, my mind is swimming with the notion that there really are, no kidding, in the real world, human beings who have alien blood. Who are they? How do we know this? And how much blood do they have? And what difference does it make?
Well, now you're getting into the real truth of the matter and the investigation of the thing, which has to do with the bloodlines. Okay, who's been interested so much in the bloodlines? Well, the
Mormons,
the pharaohs. Let's go all the way back to pharaohs, and then the Caesars of Rome, the royalty of Europe, the Windsors that are now the ruling family in Britain, and guess who's related, blood relations to the Windsors? George W. Bush, Al Gore, John Kerry, and Barack Hussein Obama.
Wow, that's pretty amazing. How far removed?
I think it was Lynn Cheney, Dick Cheney's wife, who was researching a book on the Cheney family and found out that Obama is a, just a minute, I can tell you, I think it's, I want to say 10th cousin removed. I'm getting to where I,
well, that's
I may not know everything, but I know where to go find it.
Well, that's what the internet does to you. You stop remembering things because you can just go look it up.
I know. That's unfortunately the internet has become my memory. That's
well,
kind of interesting,
it
isn't it?
A lot farther back than that, if you think about it. When the brain, when the human brain really started changing, was way back at the invention of writing, because now you don't have to remember everything.
That's true.
Prior to that, you had to remember every bit of human knowledge. Everyone had to memorize everything. As soon as you could start writing it down, you could start clearing out a big portion of your brain.
Yeah, that's true.
Brother, thing.
You know, that's something interesting. I saw a thing the other day. You know, we've kind of been told that we only use about 10% of our brain.
Yes, that is the common statement. I'm not sure it's true, but okay.
Well, it's not because well, in a way, it is because they're talking about the neurological brain or brain. It's only about 10, but the rest of the whole 100% is the software, if you will, the activity that carries the thought energy pulses in our brain. So actually, that's wrong. We actually use 100% of our brain, at least some people do.
Well, it's a holistic kind of thing. That's what they're finding out now. The brain
exactly.
is like a network, and it's something that various parts of the brain are firing in different ways and in conjunction with each other. So it's not this really geographical thing that's, you know, really narrowly defined. This area does exactly this and this area does exactly this. Part of that is true, but what they seem to be finding now is that a lot of these sections work together, and it's that overarching thing that makes us different, and that's what consciousness is.
Yes. And that's why if we actually truly were using 10% of our brain, we wouldn't be able to come up with much.
we'd be eating, sleeping, passing gas. That'd be about it, you know.
Yeah. You know, come think of it, I know a lot of people like that.
Yeah, I mean, it's not like people don't do that. That is for sure. Hey, I'm really interested because we're about to get into the break here. Just the break.
Well, quick,
let me
tell you the relationship here. What Dick Cheney's wife found in researching his family was that Barack Hussein Obama is an eighth cousin to Dick Cheney, because Obama is a descendant of Maureen Duval, a French Huguenot, whose son married the granddaughter of a Richard Cheney who had arrived in Maryland in the late 1650s from England. So that's the connection.
Wow.
So in other words, he's of the bloodline.
Fundamental question on that topic is, how much of this ancient, now alien blood do any of these people have, and what difference does it make? How are they different?
Well, all right, here's another tip off. Anyone who's actually studied the world economics understands that the Rothschild banking dynasty is way up at the top end of the pyramid of power as far as money, wealth, and position goes in the world. The Rothschilds themselves have claimed that they are the descendants of the Sumerian god king Nimrod. And in fact, they have named one of the Rothschild children Nimrod.
And that's not a flattering sounding name.
No, it's not. I know when I was in school, if somebody said, "Hey, you Nimrod," that's fighting words.
We used to use like that. Insult. Yeah, sorry. We used to use that as an insult way back in the day. You're such a Nimrod.
I know.
It's
right up there with calling somebody a dipstick.
Yeah, I'd rather be a Nimrod, I guess, than a dipstick. All right, well, Joel, I guess we're at the bottom of the hour. Why don't we fire that off?
Maybe all right.
We can bring in one or two more of our guests in. If Jim would like to stick around, we'd love to have him. Otherwise, you are...
I'm relieved of duty. Okay. All right. Well, unfortunately, I am pretty well swamped here. I'm still putting the finishing touches on an edit for a new book, so I'm going to have to run, but hey.
Jim?
Yeah. Hello.
Is that Barbara? Are we gone? America's Most Haunted, The Secrets of Famous Paranormal Places is now an epic book from Berkeley Penguin. History, legends, investigations, interviews, and profiles of America's 10 most haunted hotspots by Eric Olson and haunted housewife Teresa Argy. Be sure to join us on Twitter and Facebook at AM Haunted, Pinterest at America's Most Haunted, and our website, americas-most-haunted.com. And here every week on America's Most Haunted Radio with all the top names in the paranormal field.
When we make Beyond Natural dry dog and cat foods, we start with real meat as the first ingredient. We leave out corn, wheat, and soy. And we own where our dry food is made. 100%. Can other brands say all that? For nutrition you can trust and your pet will enjoy. Does your food go beyond? Learn more at PurinaBeyond.com.
I used to hate pooping in public. You know the feeling. Nothing is worse than stinking up the shared toilet at work or the toilet at a party or your lover's apartment. Of course, flushing removes the graphic evidence. Maybe two or three flushes if your skid marks are as tenacious as mine. But what can be done of that subtle scent of a 300 cow dairy farm? Aerosol air fresheners aren't the most effective option, or the healthiest. Trying to mask the scent, giving you a nice blend of ChemLab carnations with just a touch of feces. So, how do you make the world believe your poop doesn't stink? Or in fact, that you never poop at all? Poopery. Poopery is the before-you-go toilet spray that is proven to trap those embarrassing odors at the source and save relationships. Simply spritz Poopery in the bowl to create a film on the water's surface that actually traps the odors in their porcelain prison. And when your little astronauts splash down and make contact with the film, they release Poopery's pleasant aromas so all those around you can smell as a refreshing bouquet of essential oils. Yes, it is a real product. And yes, it really works. We've sold over 4 million bottles. On Amazon alone, there are over 1,000 reviews rating it 4.8 of 5 stars. That's a better Amazon rating than the iPhone 5. If it doesn't completely stop your stench from spreading, send it back for a full refund. Our unconditional stink-free guarantee. If your poo stinks, get your Poopery today at poopery.com. Leave a hint of mandarin, tangerine, and lily at the party with Party Pooper. Choose an aromatic blend of jasmine, fresh roses, and citrus with shitting pretty. Or choose more masculine scents like Trapper Crap or Royal Flush. So whether you need to pinch a loaf at work, cut a rope at a party, or lay a brick at your boyfriend's, your days of embarrassing smells or prairie dogging it are over. Poopery. Our business is to make it smell like your business never even happened.
All right, we're back. We're talking Contact in the Desert. I'm Eric Olson. This is America's Most Haunted. And co-hosting, engineering, producing, just being a general kick-ass individual, this evening is Joel Sturgis. And just so you know, I am Joel's co-host on his show on Thursday night.
Well, hold on, Eric. Our show, Eric.
Our show.
Our show.
I still think in terms of his, in terms of the origins. But yes, now our show, which is After Hours AM on Thursday nights. I am very excited about that. And that is also, broadly speaking, a paranormal-oriented show. So how fun is that? All right, again, we are talking Contact in the Desert. We just got off the phone with Jim Mars, very, very famous investigative journalist and best-selling author, probably the authority on the JFK conspiracy theories, and we were talking about that and also the other topics he will be addressing at Contact in the Desert. This year, the third year of Contact in the Desert, it's a little bit earlier in the year. We were asking why that was. It's because it's so damn hot in August. So this year, it will be at the, again, Joshua Tree Conference Center, but in May, May 29th through 31st. And our next guest, who we also spoke to last time, I recall, and had a very, very nice chat with before the with the preview of the last Contact in the Desert. And her name is Barbara Harris, and she is a Joshua Tree area historian and tour guide. Welcome, Barbara.
Hi, Joe. Hi, everybody. Back to the desert here. Everybody's coming back in May this time. Hopefully, it's going to be a little bit cooler. I know it'll be cooler in the evenings.
I hear some of the Flatlanders were having problems with the temperature and whatnot.
I would die in the desert. I'm from Minnesota. Okay, I'm just throwing that out there. I'll die.
You know what? It's a dry heat.
That's what they keep telling me. I've been there, and it's hot.
And you know, it's not the heat; it's the stupidity.
Oh, nah. You know what?
No, I meant humidity. I meant humidity, and there is none in the desert, which is why it's good.
But you know what? The evenings. You can't beat the evenings up here in this desert. And that's the part that's so cool and so nice, is because you go out and you look up at the stars, and then you get to see all those sparkling little stars, and then you don't know which ones you're looking at, and the ones that turn out to be UFOs, you know? But those are the ones, the people that took my tours over the past couple years, you know, that those are the ones that have had some experiences out there. Yep. Those are the ones, the giant rock that we went out there at night, and we'd look up at the stars, and I'd think that they were satellites, and we were proven wrong. They would be like pulsating and, you know, being big UFOs up there. So people had sightings out there.
Doing things that satellites do not do, in other words.
Yes. Yes, we had James Gillian with us out there, not this past year, the year before. And in one of our episodes, he pointed up to the sky, and he goes, "Oh, look, there's one right now," as James usually does. You know, he's real popular, and he knows how to point out UFOs. And me and all my brilliance, I sat there one day with him, and I said, no, that's just a satellite. And he goes, "No, it's not." And all of a sudden, he pulls out a little, you know, a little pointer, and he points up at it, and he looks at it, and he goes, "Power up." And the thing in the sky literally stops. It stops in the sky like a satellite would not do, and then it decides to go backwards. And then all of a sudden, it just starts pulsating, and you see this big light going boom, boom. And we're all standing there, my little group at the tour of Giant Rock, and we're sitting out there watching a sighting. And, yeah, those are the kind of things you get to see at Contact in the Desert.
That is amazing. It really is. And I guess I haven't really given all of the important contact info. I am glad that you reminded me of that we need to do that. So there's still plenty of tickets available. As you heard Jim say, though, boy, every year there's doubling, tripling the number of people attending. So this really is a burgeoning event. But the way to get a hold of everyone is and get all the information and see what it's all about and decide if it's for you and if you can make it, it's just go to contactinthedesert.com. They also have a Facebook page, which is very active and a lot going on there. All right, Barbara, why don't you give us a little bit of background on yourself and how you came to be the sort of Joshua Tree historian slash tour guide and the expert on giant rock, which most people or many people may not know what that is.
Yes, I'm known as the giant rock lady. And for those who don't know, giant rock was once considered the largest freestanding boulder in the world. Okay, so everybody knows about Ayers Rock in Australia, but we have our own little boulder out here in the world, in the desert. And this boulder was approximately 25,000 tons. It covers an area over like 6,000, square feet and stands about 7 stories tall. So it just sits there in the middle of this desert. And it was a very sacred space to the Native American Indians. And the Native American Indians from this area used to conduct their ceremonies. They used to actually call them seances. And they would come there, do their ceremonies, and then venture on. Now, we didn't have regular, we have nomadic Native Americans in this area. So we didn't have one specific tribe. So they would be going from maybe like Arizona on their way up to the mountains in the spring and the fall, and they would basically be stopping at this rock. And it was around the 1800s that there was the first white man named Charlie Ricci. And Charlie Ricci actually was the first white man to have a ceremony at this rock. And why he becomes important, because he eventually meets this man named Frank Kreitzer. And where Frank Kreitzer, I'm jumping ahead on a lot of this, because Frank Kreitzer becomes very important because he is a man who came out to this rock and he dug under this rock and made a home under this rock. And if anybody reads about Frank Kreitzer, he was considered a German spy. So, and this was all during World War II and a whole big time, and the government was out after him. And eventually, Frank met his demise because he blew himself up underneath the rock. So he has a whole other story.
That is a story. Wow.
Yeah, this becomes really crazy, but where it really connects cool and really neat, because you got this guy, Ricci, Kreitzer, and then Kreitzer met this man who we all know as George Van Tassel. And George Van Tassel became friends with this guy, Frank Kreitzer. And so after Frank Kreitzer kind of blew himself up under this rock, George Van Tassel, who knew Frank, kind of saw that there was this vacancy under the rock. And George Van Tassel, who lived on the coast, decided to move his family under this rock. Now, you got to remember,
they're literally living under a rock. I'm sorry, I couldn't pass. I couldn't let that one go. Yeah. I apologize.
Now, here's the interesting thing. Frank Kreitzer, he moved there because he was going to do mining. You got to go back to like the early, 20th century, and it was 1930, around that time, 1930, 1940s. And he was going to mine that area. And what was happening in that particular area is the government was giving away land. They were doing this thing called homesteading. So you could go out to the desert and pick up 5 acres of land for free. However, Frank's story gets real involved and real in-depth, and that's what I will go into at my talk Contact in the Desert. And I'll connect the pieces of why he is so important with George Van Tassel, because one of the things that Frank Kreitzer did is he built the airport. He built an airport out of Giant Rock. And for many people who don't know, there is an airport called Giant Rock Airport. So after he did blow himself up under this rock, George Van Tassel had like this ready-made home. He had an airport there, and he decided to move his family out to this place in the desert. And once George moved his family out to this desert location, George Van Tassel then started having his own experiences out there. And on April 1947, George Van Tassel had his first UFO convention go on out there, because prior to that time, he had had contact with these beings from Venus who came down, and how George had said what had happened was they had talked to him. And the gist of the whole conversation went that, you know, you human beings, you're coming along okay as a species, but it seems like when you finally get to the place where you get it and you understand what's going on, you die. So these people, these beings from Venus, gave George Van Tassel some technology and gave him some plans on how to build the Integratron. So how many people out there, you've heard of the Integratron, haven't you?
I've heard of it, but I don't know what it is.
Okay. So the Integratron was also then a part of what made George Van Tassel, you know, that's part of his legacy. Because here you have George Van Tassel, this guy now, he lives out at this giant rock in the desert with his family. And he builds a restaurant out there, and he has UFO conventions going on out there where, get this, now you got to go back to the 1950s and 1960s and early 1970s, where it was documented in 1959 where as many as 15,000 people came out to this boulder to listen to George Van Tassel. And some of the original contactees, like when you go back to George Adamski, Daniel Fry, and, you know, the original people that would have these contacts with extraterrestrials at the time, and they would gather out there in the desert, and they would have these speakers on stands, and they would come into the airport, and they would fly in and with their airplanes. They would come in with motorhomes. It was kind of like the Burning Man of its time, if you might say. And it was a place where people could come and talk about their experiences. And this was a big event. And what came off of it was George Van Tassel was able to use this as a launch pad in order for him to build his Integratron, which was supposed to be a rejuvenation machine that would help humans live longer. So, but that never happened because Van Tassel died before it ever got turned on.
Ironically enough.
Yeah. So, you know, it's a fascinating whole story, and how they all connect together is just, it all is just so amazing. And what has driven me to this place, you know, because you go out there and it is in the desert. And we take our tours and we take people out there, you know, they trust me to drive them out there to this desert rock. And you sit there in the middle of the night. We actually stay till it gets very dark so we can watch the night skies. And you have to kind of go back to that time in the 40s, 50s, and 60s when there wasn't a time where you had porta potties and you had the convenience of air conditionings and a lot of the convenience that you have today. And you sit out there, and if not anything, you could almost feel the spirits of the past and all the people that used to come to that area to experience these contacts and these, you know, the experience of, you know, listening to people talk about X-Files, and people talk about their experiences of having contact with extraterrestrials before people were allowed to talk about it. You know, that's where it was kind of breaking through. And the exciting thing, too, about this, you know, we have this, this is our own little desert thing, because you figure at the same time, in this same period of time, Roswell was happening. But, you know, Roswell was getting all the press. Roswell was getting all the notoriety. But out here, this was going on here in our little neck of the woods, our little desert. So it was kind of a neat little thing. And what's really another little thing, too, being a historian, when I first came out here and I started talking to people about it and really talking to a lot of the old-timers, their recollection of that particular time, noting and seeing UFOs in the skies, the local skies, was so secondary. It was commonplace that in many of the newspapers and newsletters and local little newsletters that the little communities had here, they would have people call in and document their sightings. So that's what became so interesting to me, too, as a historian here.
Well, we've kind of circled back around, haven't we? And we have this new-ish kind of collective campfire that we call the internet. And it just, you know, there isn't a day that goes by that these sites don't. I mean, there's so many UFO sites now, and they're putting up literally daily sightings from around the world. It's become very commonplace. People can talk about it. They can debate the reality of the video or the photos or the experiences. And I think that has really, and via the internet, a lot of, I think, more than in the past, until you get back into the time frame you're talking about, the mainstream media is picking up on it too. So we've kind of circled back around from 50, 60, 70 years ago, when some of this was, you know, pretty well perceived to be something that was inevitable. And then it kind of went away and became a poo-pooed topic, and it really seems to be coming back again, I think. That's pretty amazing that you're able to go out on your tour. So not only do you speak at the actual conference and talk about the rock and experiences and the history of the area, but you also take a tour out to the rock itself. Now, as I understand it, something happened to the rock in 2000 or thereabouts. What was that? What happened?
Oh, yes. In February of 2000, the rock split. And how it was perceived that in some of the documentation that has been written, there was a Hopi prophecy. And the Hopi prophecy had mentioned that if this rock split, and it split down the middle, it meant that mankind was going to be doomed, that, you know, we were going to cease to exist as a species. But if it split to either side, that we would continue on and life would go on and we would learn from it. And, of course, the rock did split. Now, as a historian, I also have to discuss, you know, and being very discerning about how it split and why it split. There are also other stories about that behind that story. So those are things I will also cover in my talk when I do have my speaking engagement on Saturday at Contact in the Desert. But, you know, for many people, what I always say, no matter what happened to that rock is millions of years old, millions. And no matter what happened, it picked February 21st, the year 2000, to split off. And for me, that's always the time and date is always makes it auspicious, no matter what, why, and all the circumstances of how it happened. But, you know, because when you have something that old, it could have split any time. Some people say, you know, it was because of the hot and cold. Somebody put a bomb under it. Somebody did it. Somebody did this and that. And there are a lot of facts and science behind why it could have split at that particular spot. but you always just, I always go back to somewhat of the numerology and the time and the place of why it might have split that time. So, you know, and I like to examine that and get people thinking a little bit.
But interesting.
To something you mentioned about the documentation that we had, you know, an interesting thing as a historian, you know, when we document history, especially going back to the 30s, 40s, and history previous to the smartphone, the only way we documented it was word of mouth. And as we know, people have a tendency to exaggerate, or they take stories and will make them into something different over time. So, you know, a lot of the stories and things that I have on Giant Rock, you know, you have your newspaper articles and you have the oral histories and you have those things. But today, how we document our history is almost instantly because of our cell phones, because of that instant documentation we can do. But, and then I'm going to give a butt to that, because even when we can document history exactly how it's when it's happening, we still have a controversy sometimes of that. So, you know, that's why it's always nice to discuss it and to have people of science and other people examine photos and examine things with regards to especially things like UFOs and other things that are out there. And today, especially with when you have technology such as Photoshop. And I'm going to give you an example. 2 weeks ago, just here in Joshua Tree, I was out and about, and we were with a friend, and we were over at a railroad museum just down the road from where the Contact in the Desert is being held. And a friend of mine took a picture of me and my husband while we were in this railroad. And when she went home, she downloaded a bunch of photos to me. And when we got the photos back, I opened them up and I went, ha ha, nice trick photoshopping the UFO in the background. And she emailed me back and she goes, what are you talking about? She had no idea that when she took the picture of me and my husband, there's a UFO in the background of our photograph. And that was 2 weeks ago.
That is, wow. Yeah, talk about the proof in the pudding, I guess. Yeah. Now, you live out there, right?
Yep, I live here. And actually the place where it was, and we put it up on Facebook and we had everybody in the world examine it. I examined it. It's, you know, and everybody wanted to know how fast was it going, what kind of speed, you know, were you shooting this at, what are you doing it at? And, you know, nowadays you can do all, you know, you examine it really thoroughly, and you can't unravel this one. It's here, and you just really have to say, yep, we don't know what it is. We have no idea. And we didn't even know it was in the photo. Nobody knew. Nobody saw it when it was taken, and so we have this picture of all, and I even remember going on this little thing singing, you know, I'll take the last train to Clarksville. We were waving, and the UFOs there sitting in the background. So
it's too, you know, funny. Well, that is an amazing story to end with. Our time has gone so quickly. Thank you so much, Barbara. It was really a pleasure to speak with you again. We are talking about Contact in the Desert. And we had a nice visit with Jim Mars and now Barbara Harris. They are both speaking at the event in various guises, in various forms. And Barbara also leads a tour group out to Giant Rock in the middle of the desert, where you can see some of the stuff for yourself. She told us, in fact, on one of the tours a couple of years ago for this very event, Contact in the Desert, they really did see a UFO out in the desert. It's amazing. If you're interested in attending what has become, in many people's opinion, the most important UFO convention in the U.S., again, it's Contact in the Desert, and the website is contactinthedesert.com. www.miracleswostmodernradio.com. This year, the event will be at the end of May. There's about 36 speakers covering a wide range of topics, pretty much anything you can think of that has to do with aliens, history of aliens, UFOs, and on and on. And it is quite an event. All right. Well, Barbara, thank you so much for stopping by. I know you're going to have a great time. And I envy all of those who get to attend.
No, please come. We'll have a good time. And definitely, definitely, I will almost promise we'll see something in the sky somewhere. So, okay?
All right. So,
thank you for having me.
Thank you so much. All right, I'm Eric Olson. This is America's Most Haunted Radio. We're here live on the IPBN network every Tuesday night at 8 Eastern, 7 Central. And now I also join Joel Sturgis every Thursday night at 9 Eastern, 8 Central.
Yes, you do, man. And we're on several different radio networks. I just want to let everyone know that as well that might be hearing, including Art Bell's Dark Matter Radio.
Fantastic. Well, I'll keep my mouth shut then. Oh, no, I have to talk. It's radio. All right. Well, thanks for all the help, Joel. And we will see all of you on Thursday night and next Tuesday with America's Most Haunted.